So hello, everybody. Turns out that giving a talk about quorum sensing right after Bonnie is not what you'd call a winning strategy. But to sort of cut my losses, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you half a talk about quorum sensing. And if time permits, I'm going to give you half a talk about some recent work we've been doing in metagenomics, because I noticed that nobody else has been talking about metagenomics so far. I wanted to motivate this talk with asking a particular question about this network. There's so many questions you could ask, but I think one that stands out is, why are there so many feedbacks in this network? And you saw some of them in Bonnie's talk, but I'll show you that there are actually even more. And of course, people should feel free to ask questions.
I think they do.
Yeah, I think so. Most people should feel free. This is the part where the talk tries to be seamless. I'm actually showing you the same network that Bonnie talked about, where you have the three different autoinducers being made by the three different synthases, three different transmembrane receptors, all feeding down into the same pathway, where ultimately you get phosphorylation of LuxO. That leads to production of these small RNAs, which regulate, among other things, AFE and LuxR. So let's just go through, because my former student made this fun slide where all things happen dynamically. So now, as you go up, the cells make these autoinducers. And when they make the autoinducers and the autoinducers bind to the receptors stop being kinases, so they stop phosphorylating the pathway. And the phosphate drains out of the pathway. Now LuxO is no longer active as a transcription factor. You don't get small RNAs, and when you don't get small RNAs, you destabilize the message for AFE, so you don't get AFE, but at the same time, you stop degrading the message for LuxR, so you get LuxR, and LuxR regulates all of these downstream things, including light, and so the cells light up. Okay, great. So that looks fine, right? We'd be perfectly happy. We could go home now and say we understand the quorum sensing network. But the problem is that that's not the whole quorum sensing network. Forgetting just the targets, it's got all of these internal feedbacks. And so you saw some of them, that the QRRs are regulating LuxO, and as well as regulating the synthase and the receptor for one of the signals. But there's a lot of other feedbacks in here too, right? So here's a perfect click of feedbacks. So LuxR, it turns out, positively regulates the small RNAs that are repressing it. AFE negatively regulates the small RNAs that are activating it. AFE and LuxR repress each other, and for good measure, they repress themselves. And you know, there may be other feedbacks. This is not absolutely guaranteed that we know all of the feedbacks, because they're subtle. And I should say, I mean, this is all based on work in Bonnie's lab. So these are all real. You know, they're verified. You can see that if you change these in various ways by changing the binding sites for DNA binding factors, that you get changes. So the question is, like, how are we going to understand this? And let me just finish the sentence. The point is that if you knock out something like LuxU or LuxO, the effect is you don't get quorum sensing. So that's very clear. It's sort of a binary thing. But if you knock out these, you still get quorum sensing. It's just a little bit different. So it's clearly a quantitative question. And so this asking this question immediately motivates trying to do some quantitative experiments to look at how the network actually functions. Yeah?
So was it the repression of LuxM, LuxN, which was supposed to be a sink for the micro?
So any
time. Not in the network yet, right? So.
I mean, I think I totally agree with Bonnie that a natural explanation for why there is degradation of the QRRs by at least some of the targets is to give you some rapid turnover. Because under certain circumstances, right, you're going to want to get rid of these QRRs. They have to have somewhere to go. The thing to keep in mind in all of this is that it works as a system, right? So you don't have to have degradation by every target to have something that will pull down the pool of all the QRRs. Just one or a few targets that lead to their degradation would be enough. Great. All right, so where do we go with this? And the where we went is actually working with a joint student of Bonnie and mine, Xiwen Tang, building on work by other joint students, we've been training students together for a while, to quantify the input-output relation of this network. And the idea was, well, you have these three inputs and you have potentially many outputs, but let's just start with the simplest thing that we could think of that would be interesting, which was to look at two inputs and basically look at LuxR as the output and see if we could understand that at least at a quantitative level, or at least measure it at a quantitative level. And so the idea was to make a fluorescent reporter where LuxR is a fusion with a fluorescent domain of mCherry, get rid of one of these receptors, also get rid of the synthases for the other signals, because fortunately, you know, based on Bonnie's work here, there's ways of chemically synthesizing and obtaining these autoinducers. So we have those in hand, so we can control the inputs. And so there you go. There's our strain. We can make AI1, add AI1, AI2 in any quantifiable amount. And so let's see, you know, what kind of things do you see? Well, what we want to do, we're interested not just in the sort of average response, because one of the issues here that Bonnie touched on was, well, you know, these cells are doing quorum sensing. They're supposed to be responding to cell density. You know, how accurately is any single cell able to, you know, measure cell density and respond to it? So in order to answer that question, you've got to look at single cells. And so the idea here was to do microscopy of these LuxR fluorescent fusions to see how bright each individual cell is, normalized by how big it is, and ask, well, what's the distribution of that? And so here are just a few cases. For example, let's say that you have, you know, no autoinducers at all. So if you have no autoinducers, that's like being at low cell density. You don't expect to have much of LuxR because that's the high cell density master regulator. And indeed, you don't. But you see that there is a measurable distribution of the brightnesses of the cells. And this is then a histogram of how many LuxR there are. And by various means, we were able to get an exact number of those. So you can actually quantify those. That's based on looking at fluctuations when the cells divide, so binomial partition. I'm not sure that knowing this number is essential, but for the record, we actually know how many copies we're talking about. Now, as you turn on the autoinducers, you can see that various things happen. As Bonnie mentioned, you can turn on AI2, which is this universal signal, and indeed, you sort of begin to get quorum sensing. You get a certain amount of LuxR. But under these circumstances, the cells actually respond more strongly to their intra-species signal, AI1. So you see that AI1 alone, without AI2, gives you a stronger response. But you get an even stronger response if you have both autoinducers present. And we don't need the third autoinducer because the receptor is not there. So it's not playing any role. So that's just, you know, four different inputs. But in fact, we can look at the whole two-dimensional array of inputs by giving quantified amounts of AI1 and quantified amounts of AI2 and measure these distributions. And here I've just extracted the mean and the noise, which is the standard deviation over the mean. And you can see, well, indeed, you know, this is quorum sensing. As the autoinducer concentration goes up, you get more and more of this master regulator LuxR. But you can also see, well, you know, there's different amounts of noise. I should say, though, that if you can't see the numbers, the noise variation isn't huge. This is going from, you know, 0.18 to 0.34. So even as you change by an order of magnitude the mean, the noise is only changing by a relatively small fraction. And for you know, biochemical circuits based on gene expression, this noise is relatively low. So these are relatively quiet circuits compared to some things that you might see.
Yeah, in the top panel, yeah, autoinducer 1 plus 2, is that the total concentration is 1 micromolar, or is it 1 micromolar of each?
1 micromolar of each. Yeah, but that's basically saturating. So I think effectively it's not going to matter very much. I mean, you're way up. Here's nanomolar, so there's micromolar. So you're kind of up in this corner. I mean, there might be small variations. All right, so, yeah?
What's the measure of noise here?
This is standard deviation over the mean. Okay. Yeah?
It's difficult to see, but basically the whole distribution shift, and on the log scale it would be very similar, and you don't see dark cells.
Right. You do not see this sort of bimodal distribution where some guys have lit up and other guys are dark. These are, you know, sort of like the soldiers in lockstep, trying to keep together. Yeah.
So at what point in that mean graph do you actually see light? Is the natural response of quorum sensing dark?
That's a question. Light actually seems to have a rather ultra-sensitive response. It seems to, you know, turn on rather abruptly. I actually don't know the number here. It's a fair question, but even if I knew the answer, it would be hard to say how that relates to the ecology of these cells. But
I guess, yeah. I was more asking because you can imagine that in this case, neither one alone can ever get you to full quorum sensing mode.
Yeah, so this is exactly where this is going. So might as well take a moment here. That the picture that I'm going to push today is that this circuit is doing more than sensing low density versus high density. That this circuit is actually trying to get more than one bit of information about the cell density. And in fact, while light as an output may itself be rather, discrete and binary, there are definitely other outputs of this circuit that are more graded, including some outputs that are low at low cell density, low at high cell density, and peak in the middle, which is sort of your best case to say there's more than one bit there. So, all right. So, but this was, you know, the motivation for this was to say, well, can we get some understanding of what these feedbacks are doing? So we had to quantify what the input-output relation looked like, and now we can do the same quantification, knocking out those feedbacks. And in making some choices about what to look at, Xu Wen, measured a number of different constructs. So here is the sort of quote-unquote wild type, the ones that's the engineered strain that we were using before. So this is the same. Basically the same data you just saw, but you could take out, for example, the feedbacks onto LuxO. You could take out the feedback onto this receptor and its synthase, although in this case you don't care as much about the synthase because you're adding the autoinducer yourself. Or looking at some combination where you take out the feedbacks also from LuxR or something where you know all of these. And so all right, so when you look at this, you know, it's hard to know exactly what to make of it. But I think the take-home message is that you haven't destroyed quorum sensing, right? If you sort of start at this lower left corner and go to the upper right corner, it all kind of looks the same. On the other hand, you've certainly made quantitative changes. And so these feedbacks seem to be coming in, playing the role, not that they're absolutely necessary, but they are affecting, you know, how much response you get under which conditions to how much autoinducer. And so I think it's then worth digging in a little bit to say, all right, can we learn anything? Can we, at a conceptual level, you know, what should we conclude from this? And so so let's look at what we see. And so the first thing that we can conclude from this is by looking specifically at that feedback onto the receptor LuxN. So by looking at the wild type and at the mutants, I might as well bring up the full screen here, we learn the following, that this feedback basically has the following role, that you start out at low cell density. Low cell density, remember, you're making a lot of these small RNAs, so you're repressing this receptor. So in terms of a ratio, there's a low ratio of this LuxN receptor to the other receptors in the cell. And as a result, you're not really paying attention to that signal, right? Even if you got that signal, it would only shut off the kinase activity of a small minority of all the receptors. On the other hand, as the cell density goes up, and you stop repressing this, you get more and more of these receptors. And you can see that here in the level of LuxN mRNA, but you can also see it in the terms of LuxN protein. As a result, you've become much more sensitive to this signal. So it's really a matter of attention. The cells are paying attention to, for example, AI2, which would be this universal signal. And then as that starts to accumulate in the environment, they turn their attention to a different signal. So it's a very simple network, but it has the same kind of idea that, you know, higher organisms have, of that we're not just sort of passively waiting for inputs, we're actively, you know, looking for particular inputs under particular circumstances. So I think that's, you know, a real feature of the circuit, and, you know, that can help explain what one of these feedbacks is doing. So, okay, but there are a lot of feedbacks. That was just this one of them. And sort of one of the things that you immediately think of, because many of these feedbacks, essentially all of them are negative feedbacks, is you think, okay, that must be about reducing noise. And that was certainly my first thought. And that's why it's a good reason to do experiments. Because it turns out that if you look at all of the various mutant strains and you look at you know, how the noise relates to LuxR copy number, you basically get one curve. It's not like, you know, oh, this mutant has, you know, huge amount of noise compared to the others up here. They're basically all following this curve, which is some version of Poisson-like statistics. You know, really Poisson statistics related to how many mRNAs you have, because those are leading to bursts of protein production. In other words, you know, at least for the set of feedbacks that we looked at, you know, getting rid of them is not hugely increasing the noise in the circuit. So you can't argue that those, you know, that all those feedbacks are about noise reduction. Yeah. These are exactly, you know, the motley crew of mutants that we made here. And so you could, I mean, I think it's fair to argue that, you know, maybe there are some of the feedbacks, because there are others from, you know, from AFE onto the small RNAs, there are other feedbacks that could overall be playing a role in noise reduction. But certainly getting rid of these, we saw no increase of noise. So I don't think that you could explain it all away as, oh, that's the universal answer.
Going around the slide, just out of curiosity, is there some logic to these particular sets of mutants that motivated to work hard on the PEs?
Yes.
Good.
They were the first five feedbacks that we found, right? And we actually didn't have the others at the time that we started it, right?
Good, because I had lost that. Yes. No, these were the ones we knew about at the time, and I think that's been a fair question. Like, maybe, you know, maybe this is worth revisiting. And there may be some that are playing a role in noise reduction. But I think we do still learn something. We did learn something from these beyond the turning your attention. We do learn that it's not all about noise. So what else could it be about? And so here is basically the strongest effect we saw by locking out the feedbacks was the following: that here's the wild type response. Now I'm doing something which is, you know, a combined model for increasing the cell density. I'm just adding both autoinducer 1 and autoinducer 2. And you see, you get this response where the level of LuxR goes up from, you know, 100 copies to order 800 copies or 700 copies. Some of the mutants have very little effect on that, but if you look at the mutants that knock out the feedbacks from LuxR, you get a very different shape. You get something that looks much more ultra-sensitive. So, in fact, thinking about that, you know, this is then in some ways the natural shape of this curve, and you put the feedback in to spread this out. So, in fact, what this feedback is doing is it's increasing the input dynamic range. It's making the response to autoinducer more graded. At the same time, it's also knocking down the upper level of LuxR. So it seems that this particular feedback, which is the one that seems to have the strongest effect, is sculpting the input-output dynamic ranges here. So ultimately, I think this is actually, you know, a good take-home message, that this is the kind of response you'd want if you were trying to learn one bit about the environment. You were just trying to learn, am I at low cell density or am I at high cell density? You'd have a curve that looked like that. You'd either be down here or you'd be up there. But if you want to learn more than one bit, you'd better have an input-output relationship that looks like this. And so maybe that, at least one of the important roles of these feedbacks, is trying to get more than one bit. So now I want to have a little bit of an aside. Part of the goal of having me and Bonnie both talk at the same time was to give a little bit of an impression of how we work together as a team. Bonnie is an experimentalist, me as a theorist, our groups having these different expertises. Up till now, basically, I've just been telling you about experiments that were done in Bonnie's lab by a student that she did most of the supervision of. So, you know, so what am I doing here? So what I do is I enjoy talking with Bonnie. I learn a lot. And every now and then, some of the things we're doing together leads to some kind of conceptual question that we can run with. And so just as an example of that, I wanted to talk about some work I've done recently with a postdoc, Thibaut Telefumier, which is exactly of that character. And it's motivated by all of these feedbacks and this idea that you want to get more than one bit. And the question that it raises, well, okay, how many bits can you get? You know, like what's the optimum? How should you, what kind of circuit should you have if you can have these feedbacks that would maximize the mutual information between cell density and something inside each cell that is it would be its internal representation of cell density. And I don't want to spend a huge amount of time on this, so I just want to sort of give you the flavor. And the idea is, you know, now we can say, well, Fibrio-Harveyi, 3 signals, small RNAs. Okay, that's, you know, very interesting and complicated, and I'm sure there's much many things we'll learn about nature from that. But let's just back off and say, all right, let's imagine that the cell could design any internal circuitry it wanted. What should it be doing? And so there we can say, you know, here's a cell. It's in a colony which has some cell density, and that's what it's trying to learn about. And what is the cell, what the cell can be doing is it's, obviously, it's got to be sensing the autoinducer concentration. It can't directly sense cell density. And of course, it's actually making the autoinducer. So at a simple level, you say, well, OK, cells just make autoinducer. And when there are more cells, there's more autoinducer. But you may say, well, OK, but you know that's fine. But maybe you should make more autoinducer when you're at low cell density so that you can get to the threshold for detection a little earlier. And maybe make a little less autoinducer at high cell density, and you say, oh, okay, well maybe that makes sense. And then you can say, well, also, you know, what about the internal representation? You know, do I just simply have the receptor directly drive the production of some protein inside, or maybe because the amount of noise in that protein will be higher when there is few copies, maybe I should have some feedback from the protein onto itself. And so the idea is basically to say, let's say the cell could do anything it wanted within sort of some simple network schemes of, you know, transcription factor-based regulation or small RNA-based regulation, where this is just a direct sort of feed-forward system where autoinducer affects some transcription factor which leads to production of protein, or autoinducer affects some transcription factor that makes small RNAs that in turn regulate the amount of production of protein. But
sorry, what does MP stand for?
Okay, MP is not military police, it is monitor protein. It's okay. I mean, it's just Luxar in this case. But so I don't want to show you a bunch of equations, but for example, you can look at the system and you can ask for, you know, any kind of feedbacks that I want. You know, could I optimize this? And this turns out to be a nice optimization problem which you can actually solve exactly. And there's some, I think, interesting conclusions. That is, if you look at the total amount of mutual information, and these parameters are sort of things that would be relevant in the circuit, the burst size, how many proteins get made from each small RNA, this G plus is a measure of the absolute, you know, strength of negative feedback that I allow in the circuit. You first see that, you know, this color scheme here says more mutual information is a hot color, that you can actually get more mutual information about cell density from small RNA-based regulation than from transcription factor. And the basic reason for this is the following, that most of the noise in the circuit comes from the fact that you have a small number of mRNAs for the monitor protein for LuxR. And so that's where you can trace the noise. And the reason you have a finite as opposed to infinite amount of mutual information is because the circuit is noisy. If there was no noise, I would just have an exact number of monitor proteins. I would know the exact cell density, and I'd know everything I wanted. But the proteins that I'm making inside the cell are subject to stochastic fluctuations. And the root of those is the fact that there are a relatively small number of mRNAs, each of which is being translated many times. The big deal with small RNAs is that small RNAs regulate the lifetime. They reduce the lifetime of these messages. So when you're regulating with small RNAs, you end up with shorter-lived mRNAs. And therefore, each mRNA leads to the production of fewer proteins. You have smaller burst sizes and therefore smaller noise. And so this is something that has been remarked on before, but it's absolutely true. And even when you say, given optimum tuning of all the things, this is sort of the optimal solution, it's still true. But what wasn't apparent is that given the presence of only a transcription factor regulation, adding optimal feedbacks does almost nothing for you. You get very, very little increase of the mutual information. On the other hand, if you have a small RNA-based regulation system, then suddenly you can significantly increase the total amount of mutual information by including these feedbacks. And it really comes down to the sort of the same origin, that by taking advantage of the short lifetime of the mRNAs in the case of small RNAs. I see a lot of puzzled looks, but okay.
So I was just wondering, what's sort of the global resource constraint that you're imposing, right? You have to have some...
Yes.
Comparing two scenarios.
Yeah, the two scenarios are that you don't get to make an infinite amount of protein, because then the relative noise would go down. So you're
getting to make a lot of mRNAs in one case and not so much in
the other. That's true. So I absolutely agree. And you know, you might have said, well, why doesn't everything use mRNAs? Well, maybe the energy cost is a factor. But yes, we are being fair here. We're saying, you know, all of these circuits to be compared go from, you know, 100 copies of LuxR, the monitor protein, to 1,000 copies. That's all fixed. You don't get to cheat that way. Yeah.
So a related question: doesn't the time show up in this? So you may say that you're interested in not just neutral points, but channel capacity. Okay. And then the question is how fast you can get. If you measure very slowly, you can average in this one.
So I think time comes in the real world, and not in our case in this model. We're assuming a quasi-static picture where you're sitting at some cell density that is changing slowly enough that you're just measuring. But you know, it's easy to say that you can just average something. But the circuit that you use to average is, you know, this monitor protein. And if you want to, you know, that, so you are doing averaging. So that is built, so that in a sense is built into the model. You could imagine saying, well, I could build in yet more things which would average even longer and so on. But there is a natural time scale here that the autoinducer concentration is going to be increasing as the cells are growing. They're doubling every hour or something. So you don't want to average for much longer than that. And a monitor protein, of course, is basically averaging over a lifetime set by dilution. So it's sort of the right time scale.
Conceivably, you want to measure rapidly, especially there is this issue with sort of several signals coming in through the same hub of LuxR, and you probably get asked all the time how is there some of the possibility to discriminate between the different words, different languages there, and you know, probably people immediately think of time domain multiplexing. So suddenly maybe you want to generate some temporal dynamics, if not in the signal itself, then in the reception of different signals, and then try to differentiate them that way.
So I appreciate your intuition there. I think that one has to come back to what's sort of the likely ecology of these bugs, which is that, you know, under what circumstances are you going from low cell density to high cell density? Well, it's unlikely that they evolved to be centrifuged or something, right? So that this is going to happen based on growth. They're going to be in some colony or in the light organ of a squid, and they're growing. And so that's taking hours for that to happen. The one thing that they could very likely do fast is go from high cell density to low cell density. So a cell could be expelled from the from the host, it could fall out of the biofilm. And I believe, in fact, that there are features of the circuit that strongly suggest that it has been designed for an accelerated response to that transition from high cell density to low cell density. I don't, however, see in the circuit things that would be, you know, responding to oscillating signals or, you know, very different time courses of the different autoinducers. But I do think that that particular event in the cell's life, going from high cell density to low cell density, is real, and we see evidence for it.
You can also imagine that it's not a matter of how fast, it's a matter of being first. And the fable of two light years on the bear, right?
Well, I think, yeah. Right, certainly.
Okay, no, no.
Yeah.
I guess I have a question about how you set this up. Is there a particular place in which you're applying feedback, or is it a class of models with feedback applied in various steps in the model? Or, like from the previous slide where you showed us the three things,
yeah.
I guess my question is, you're changing the amount of feedback quantitatively, but where exactly is the feedback?
Yeah, the feedback is going into the production of autoinducer. So here, it's going back to the production of autoinducer and also to the production of the protein itself. Just those two places. Okay. So this is actually very well motivated by Boris's point that in fact this feedback from LuxR that you know that has a strong effect on the degree of ultrasensitivity of the response also seems to be playing an important role in the kinetics of the circuit. And this is exactly this point I was talking about, where you go from high cell density to low cell density. And so what this is supposed to show is that if you look at the levels of the QRRs in wild type, when you've gone from high cell density to low cell density, you very rapidly start making these QRRs. So you go from high density to low density, you make a lot. But in the absence of this, of LuxR, which remember is positively feeding back onto the small RNA. So the idea is you're sitting here at high cell density. Everything's good. But you know that something bad could happen. You could get knocked out of the biofilm, or you could get expelled from the squid. So you're fine, but you want to be prepared. And so the way you're prepared is that you have a lot of LuxR, and if suddenly you get expelled into the ocean, and so the autoinducer concentration goes down, then on a very, very fast time scale, you start making these small RNAs. And the presence of LuxR greatly accelerates that production. It is a co-activator of the production of the small RNAs. So you're sitting here at high cell density, you're chock full of LuxR. If you suddenly lose the signal, you make small RNAs very fast. That seems to be the case. I mean, these are measurements that you are making the small RNAs fast, and that production depends on LuxR. You could then say, like, okay, well, why? You know, why do I want to make the small RNAs so fast? What good does that do me? Here's some equations. You don't really need these equations to understand what I'm going to say. What I'm going to say is that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to make small RNAs super fast if all they're going to do is stop production of a particular protein. Because I've got this protein, for example, LuxR or one of the other targets. Let's say I make small RNAs really fast, so I stop making this protein. Well, this protein is still sitting there, right? It's not going away until it dilutes. Now, you could argue, well, maybe I make a protease or something, but you don't. So what's the point of having the world's fastest switch that stops production of something if you don't get rid of the stuff you've got? So that doesn't make sense. But what does make sense is the role of the small RNAs in positively regulating this other transcription factor, AFA. So remember, as Bunny talked about, the small RNAs are repressing LuxR, but they're activating AFA. So now I'm sitting here at high cell density, got lots of LuxR, I've got no AFA. I suddenly turn on production of the small RNAs, super high. These bind to AFA, they stabilize it and let it be translated. And so the AFA protein comes up fast from basically zero, an unmeasurable level. And that's worth doing quickly, right? Going from zero to some number that can now be active as a transcription factor, the faster I can do that, the faster I can turn on the regulon associated with AFA and low cell density. So at least, you know, we can't ask these cells, is this why you're doing it? But at least it holds together. There's a logic to this circuit. And it suggests that that there's this particular role of the fast kinetics of the small RNAs in regulating AFA. And this also goes back to something Bonnie said, that we see in nature a correlation, I think it's an exact correlation, between the number of small RNAs in the cell, 5 versus 1, and whether this AFA. So if you're regulating AFA and you want that to be fast, it kind of makes sense to have 5 copies, because that will also increase the dosage of the small RNAs, particularly at this transition going from high density to low density. And the last thing he says, well, you know, maybe I just want a lot of QRRs, it's not about AFA. But there's also this negative feedback. It's as soon as you made enough AFA, it feeds back negatively, say, we don't need so many small RNAs anymore. So it kind of makes sense that it was all about getting AFA made quickly. Once you've made the AFA, you can tamp down the production of the small RNAs. So, you know, maybe this is a fantasy, but at least we have a kind of working model for how this circuit is, why this circuit is designed the way it is. Yeah.
So building on your teleology, does that then also mean that AFA is dominant over LuxR on downstream components that they share? So you can imagine that if AFA shuts down something LuxR needs, or not LuxR,
uh-huh.
sensing needs, high cell density physiology needs, AFA dominates, and therefore it's not really important to speed up the degradation. As long as AFA is there, it's going to invalidate.
That's a great question. I don't think we know the answer to that. I will say that there are definitely overlaps of these binding sites. So that's a real possibility, that AFA is able to compete off LuxR, not independently, but like really directly. We should write this down. They did that. You can answer. So
it happens at both ends, right? You make AFA, and then it swamps out LuxR when the cells are at low cell density. Some targets are only regulated by AFA. Some are only by LuxR. But then you have these interesting ones. Right? And so then AFA wins at low cell density, and when the reverse happens, LuxR wins at high cell density, because you're always getting, and they also mutually repress each other to commit them to those things. And I think, you know, we have a few examples where it works just like you're saying.
Okay, so thank you. Good question, good answer. I will, just to recap, this scenario where the network is in part designed to accelerate this high cell density to low cell density response does give some kind of accounting for why there might be multiple QRRs, multiple of the small RNAs, as a dosage effect that's important for the speed of this response. Why LuxR is a co-activator, it's present at high cell density, getting just ready, poised for the cells to go to low cell density to need the production of the QRRs. The same logic would say why you'd have QR repression of LuxO, that LuxO is also there at high copy number, at high cell density, waiting to drive this circuit to produce small RNAs when you go to low cell density. And I think it also gives a reasonable understanding of why you want to cap the level of LuxR. Remember, one of the roles of these feedbacks was to actually lower the maximum level of LuxR, that when you go from high density to low density, even if AFA is competing with LuxR, you do eventually want to get rid of the LuxR. You don't want to have a huge pool that will take many, many cell generations to dilute out. And as I mentioned, one of the big clues is the fact that AFA feeds back negatively on the QRR. So once AFA has built up, you don't need that high level of QRRs anymore. Okay. Yeah. No.
So in terms of the ecology of what you're modeling here, they go from high cell density to low cell density, and their growth rate is also changing.
That of course depends on on nutrient availability more than anything else. I don't know. Yeah.
What do you assume here in your simulation?
Oh, in the simulation, we have not done anything with growth rate. I mean, this is really just very simple. We're just adding a term that says increase the level of the autoinducers or the phosphorylation of LuxO.
Because your idea of the fact that the shutdown has to be fast is even more relevant if just if the low density shift is actually preventing growth and you have no dilution factor and no.
I mean, it's quite possible that going to low density, it means you're now out in the ocean as opposed to being sitting on some marine snow, some nice particle of which has carbon sources. And so it could be that there's that's an interesting idea, that there's a premium on doing it fast before you run out of resources. Ego.
Explain again why the advantage of having multiple QRRs compared to a lot of one of them?
Oh, okay. I think that from the point of view of this model, if I just put a factor of five in front of one of them, it would be fine. So, okay, so here's an issue that it's worth confronting. We see Vibrio Harveyi right now, right? There are five of these URRs, and they are not expressed at the same level. So some of them are much more expressed than others. And you say, well, geez, why didn't I just increase the rate of expression of that one? But something happened in evolution, right? And at that first step, maybe as we've heard, a gene duplication is a relatively common event, right? So maybe the first thing that happens, it's almost unavoidable to argue that at the very beginning, when you made the gene duplication, these small RNAs were identical, right? So they must have been doing exactly the same thing. Now they're regulating targets differently and so on. But back then, they were identical. So the natural explanation for that is dosage, that either at steady state or maybe here transiently, you wanted a higher dosage. And maybe you wanted a much higher dosage, so you ended up with five. So that's great, and it worked. Now another billion years goes by, or 100 million or something like that. And now you've got these five, and you could say, well, maybe I'll get rid of four of them and increase the dosage of one. But they're sitting there in the genome, right? And they're working. So maybe you don't decide to try this other solution. You stick with five. But since you've got five of them, they can start to evolve subtle differences that let them regulate targets in different ways, that let them turn on in response to different signals, and so on. So I think one has to always, everything makes sense only in the light of evolution, if it makes sense at all. But you've got to think about, what was the first step. And in the first step, clearly, they were identical. So it was probably about dosage. Now, maybe not so much.
As far as the model is concerned,
the model, it's a factor of five. There's possibility that would have an effect on noise because there's, square root of n would come in if I had a big factor of five versus five independent noise sources, but not sure about that. Yeah?
Just to be sure, so there is no dilution in this model right now?
Right now, there is not. This is a very simple model.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is a bare bones. Okay, so I'm almost at the end of what I had to say about quorum sensing, but I did want to sort of leave with, the scenario that at least I have in mind for why you have this system that wants more than one bit, and here it's helpful to realize that the bacteria, most bacteria, certainly these vibrios, have a life cycle that is at least more complex than just high cell density and low cell density. So here, for example, you have these planktonic cells. They're swimming around. They find some substrate. They've got to decide whether they're going to stay there, whether they're going to build a biofilm. And when they start building a biofilm, there's issues of, maybe oxygen is coming from this direction. Maybe this is a carbon source. But if you don't get any oxygen, you're going to suffocate. So they make these towers with lots of polymer and so on surrounding the cell. It's sort of like growing a tree and trees grow toward the sun. These cells probably grow toward sources of oxygen. But at a certain point, once you're the biggest tree in the forest, you don't want to grow any bigger. That's not useful. You want to make pine cones, right? You've got to make more cells. And so there is an increase in the rate of production of cells. You get these crypts of high cell density. But even that's not enough. You've got to release the pine cones. And so the cells start making proteases that degrade the matrix and let them go. And there's probably other things that go along here. Now, if this was, fly embryo, you just say, oh, these are, this is hour one, hour two, hour three. Everything happens according to a clock, and all the nutrients are there because the mother, provided them. But this is happening, you know, somewhere out in nature. There may or may not be nutrients. The cells may spend, this may take 12 hours, it may take 36 hours, all depending on conditions. So the only way the cells know where they are is by sensing things in their environment, including cell density. And so I think the idea is that they're constantly trying to figure out where they are in some kind of developmental process, and using the quorum sensing system, and that will then direct them to turn on and off the right genes. And so the picture we have is, for example, just in this simple space of autoinducer 1 and autoinducer 2, you could imagine starting here with very low levels of autoinducer. This is a particular output. This is actual data. And you could say, well, you know, can the cells know where they are? And here, at least, we can show that they can, at the very least, count the number of autoinducers that are present, in the sense of the number of types of autoinducer. So here, if I have no autoinducer, the cells can go by either increasing autoinducer 1 or increasing autoinducer 2, go to a new level where basically the noise cell-to-cell variation is small enough that the cells really know that they've got one autoinducer saturating, and turn on the other, they now know that they've got two. With three autoinducers, in principle, you could then go count. I mean, there are 0, 1, 2, or 3. So that gives you at least 2 bits of information. Now, you know, whether it happens like this in nature is a little unclear. Presumably, AI2 is something that's being made by lots of different bacteria, so that might be the right thing to detect first before your clonal colony, then turn on AI1 and so on. But I think, you know, absent the, you know, a real understanding of exactly the accumulation of each autoinducer in each circumstance, I think it does make sense that these cells have, you know, evolved to try to extract more than one bit of information about the surrounding cell density. And in addition to that, that's sort of the basic network, they've added on, at some point in evolution, this additional functionality of, in addition to maximizing mutual information, if we suddenly go from high density to low density, we've got to respond fast. And I think, in a way, that's why the network looks sort of Rube Goldberg-ish. It evolved to do one thing, maximize mutual information, and suddenly you said, oh, by the way, I also want this other functionality. And that was built in, not by a complete redesign, but by adding in all of these feedbacks onto an existing network. So for this summary, for this part of my talk, you know, you've now learned a lot about the terminology of quorum sensing. AFE and LuxR are these low cell density, high cell density master regulators in the Vibrio network. And unlike, you know, chemotaxis, where every bacteria basically chemotaxis using the same network, there are lots and lots of different quorum sensing networks. So, you know, there are lots of other possible variants of this, and a lot can be learned from comparing them. But by digging in to this particular network, which I think was a great insight of Bonnie's, we've really learned a lot. And in this, even in this particular study, I think we've learned a few things. That the network architecture certainly allows you to increase the information on cell density, pay attention to specific signals, and to let the cells respond quickly to this very realistic transition from high cell density to low cell density. So I want to acknowledge the people who contributed to this. Most of the experimental work, the single cell work, was done by Xu Wen, based on work that had been done by Tao Long. These are both joint students. Thibault is doing you know, real calculations on mutual information. And of course, Bonnie and some of the wonderful people in her lab did all the experimental work. We got funding from a bunch of sources. So that's a transition point. But if people saved any questions, they should ask.
Yes.
Yeah, that's good.
So is it to some extent known what kind of profile of autoinducers is seen by a biofilm as it goes through these stages, and to what extent you can put on the relations that's matched?
Okay, so there's not much work on that. You know, your colleague in Germany did a little bit of this, Kirsten. Yeah. So I can refer you to the papers. It does look like it will be spatially heterogeneous. It's sort of like there'll be different parts of a biofilm will be at different stages. So, which makes sense. I can't say much. I mean, one of the issues is it's challenging is that, you know, the production of the autoinducers will depend a lot on what you're feeding the cells, you know. So whereas you can study the network and the input-output relationships and say this is how it works, when you say, okay, which autoinducer do you make first and in how much, you're going to say, well, what's my carbon source? What am I limited for? What's the temperature? So there's a lot of parameters there. But it's an interesting question. Yeah.
And there's also, I think that question, it's a big stopper in the field, right? You can't label the autoinducers are small molecules. So it's not that you can label them, right, and look at them like they're molecules, right? And if you put a label on, they're not autoinducers anymore, you know, because the fluorescent label is just taking the other, right? And so that has been a huge stopper in this field to actually ask, you know, we can look at what the cells do, but you can't ask what is that like map of autoinducers look like? And that would be amazing. Us to be able to think about.
Amita.
So, simple question. So, these small RNAs, how specific are they in their function? So, do they regulate just a particular gene, or are they sort of more of a common good in the cell?
Well, the small RNAs, like as you saw, that in this circuit they have 20 targets that we know about. Is that the question?
The question is, if you now produce small RNA in a cell, can they be used somewhere else to, you know, if you want to reduce the growth rate of your cell, or, you know, if you're in a wrong environment, somehow you want to turn on another proteins. It's not only...
Well, I mean, it's increasingly clear that small RNAs can have just as big regulons as transcription factors, and there are comparable numbers of them in bacteria. So they are a real, you know, other regulatory system throughout the cell that can have as many varied effects as turning on or off a transcription factor. I'm not sure. I think I'm not answering your question, but rather than continue to talk, I let you try, you know, speak again. Yeah.
So the point is, so you don't make a small RNA just randomly. You make it under pressure. And once you make it, you want to use it as much as possible. So let's say you want to reduce the growth rate, so you use this small RNA for different proteins to sort of downregulate their production somehow. Is that reasonable to assume, or is it just wrong?
But this is a growth rate control mechanism.
Well, it can also be used for the growth rate control mechanism, the downregulation of other proteins. Because they're not as specific as like particular transcription factors defined through
the virus. No, I think they are as specific. I think that the answer is that they are as specific, that they're very specific targets.
All right.
Yeah.
I guess I have a more general question. So in this case, to get more information, you still need multiple autoinducers, right? Is there any system that you're familiar with that you can play around with sort of the internal machinery, just one upstream histidine kinase response regulator, but still increase the number of levels, say, you can achieve steady state at in that transition? Basically create multiple bits of information, not by increasing the number of ways you listen to something, but rather the way you interpret levels of the signal. So that goes back to earlier question of, can you have multiple quorums that lead to different outputs?
Yeah, so there's two issues. There's two answers. One is the real world, and one is sort of modeling. Modeling, absolutely. All of the modeling we've done is with one signal getting more than one bit. And I think that for me, the multiple signals is very likely a relatively easy evolutionary way to expand the dynamic range. There's only so much I can do with one autoinducer, because the receptors go from sort of getting no signal to being saturated over maybe a couple orders of magnitude. So if I want to do something just to get more range of you know, than two orders of magnitude, having more signals, one signal goes to this range, one signal goes to that range. The other quorum sensing systems have not been studied in anything like the depth and quantitation that Bonnie has studied the Vibrio. So we don't really know what exactly is happening with it. I think there are cases where there's probably one autoinducer. Yeah, there are, yeah. But it hasn't been explored at this level. Yes.
So we should probably move the remaining sort of half an hour before everybody starts starving.
Yeah, so we have like till 12:30. Is that the?
Well, we have as long as we can stomach.
Well, I don't want to. I mean, people can go without eating for a month, so.
We haven't said half an hour, so that's fine.
Got it. I've got my marching orders. All right. So, so one of the things that is actually kind of motivated by that last picture of the life cycle of cells and the discussion that you know they may be sensing AI2 from different bacteria is to make the point that in fact bacteria are found in communities of mixed species. So you look in the soil or in our bodies or so on, you find lots and lots of different species. So this is something people, I guess, had some idea, but it's become very, very clear recently because of the ability to sequence bacteria that you can't actually grow in the lab. So there's things that are non-culturable, but you can sequence them, and suddenly you see that there are hundreds or thousands of species coexisting in these various environments. And so I wanted to give, I can focus on the introductory parts of this, a little bit of a discussion of this field, which is something that I am not an expert in. I've been working with a wonderful graduate student, Mikhail Tikhonov at Princeton, who is going to work with Michael Brenner as a postdoc, and Robert Leach, who's an expert programmer on a very particular aspect of this, but I won't worry about what we've done in particular. If we don't get there, that's fine. I will start with an introduction, like what is this whole thing about? The microbiome, metagenomics, what are people actually doing? And I realize that there are actually people in the audience who may know more about this than I do, Adam over there. But so if the questions get hard, I may crowdsource this. So by way of outline, talk a little bit about the microbiome and its particular approach based on a nice tag, like a barcode that the different bacterial species have, part of the 16S ribosomal gene. And then there's some stuff that we've done looking at a particular data set. We'll see if we get there. So what is the fuss all about? This is a nice picture from Scientific American showing a kind of transparent human body. And the idea here is that if you go in and sample a little bit of material from your palm or your guts or your mouth, or your nose, and you do sequencing on that, and we'll get to what you can sequence to look at that, you will find bacteria. You will find lots and lots of different strains of bacteria. And they will actually be different wherever, all over your body. There was a recent study of looking at a human body and taking samples from something like 500 different locations. And you find that basically they're all different. There's sort of ranges that will be similar. But we should think of ourselves as sort of not just one ecosystem, like what's what bacteria live on humans? It's like the planet, that from the bacteria's point of view, we're big and very varied. This part is dry, this part is wet, this part has nutrients of this sort, this part has nutrients of the other sort. So there's a lot going on. That said, most of the bacteria are in here, in this plumbing down there. And in fact, there are probably 10 times as many bacterial cells living down there as there are total cells in your body. They're small, though, so they're only, I guess, a couple of kilograms, something like that, or 1 to 2 kilograms of bacteria, but a lot of cells and a lot of diversity.
Have similar analyses been done for other microbes, say bacteriophage or other viruses or fungi or
if you do this and you look for phage, you find tons and tons of phage, right? I think that maybe there's 100 phage particles for every bacterium. There's a lot going on down there. But you might ask, why should we care? Maybe this is irrelevant. It happens to be there, but who cares? And so in recent years, there have been a number of studies of the impact of the microbiome. And this is a particularly cool one. This is from Jeff Gordon's lab, and he's done some lovely studies using these germ-free mice. So you actually don't need these bacteria to survive. So this has not been done with humans, but it's assumed that it's certainly been done with mice, that you can have mice that are raised in a certain way that they have no bacteria, and they are alive. They're messed up in certain ways, their immune system, and so on. And they will not respond well to any, you know, if you give them a pathogen or something, they are in bad shape. But you, it's not an absolute, not absolutely essential, particularly if you feed them, you know, certain vitamins that they need. But that said, the microbiome does have an impact. And so here was kind of a somewhat gruesome schematic here. But the idea is, okay, you know, does the human biome having any effect? Well, we don't really do experiments on people, you know, that are this extreme. We don't have autobiotic or germ-free humans. But let's do the next best thing. Let's take the microbiome from some humans, give it to mice, and see what happens. But you could always say, well, everybody's different. How do we know? So the idea is you take twins. And you take twins, human twins, from a pre-existing study. And one of the twins you choose, a twin, so that the one twin is obese and the other twin is lean. So that genetically, and some of these twins were actually identical twins, so that genetically they're the same. They're just, you know, different in terms of their obesity. You take the microbiome from the twins, inject it, insert it into the germ-free mice, feed the mice the same diet, and lo and behold, the mice who were have the microbiome from the obese twin get fat, and the other mice don't. Which, you know, you have to believe that this guy is not cheating, because this is such a cool result. You feel like, you know, he would have maybe just made it up. But he's got a lot of people who work for him and then go off and get jobs and do good work. So presumably, it's not all an enormous scam. But isn't that great? So that really, you know, the microbiome has a real effect. And then you say, well, all right, why? It turns out, maybe surprisingly, they're not eating more. These are mice in the lab. You can figure out exactly what they're eating. They're not just hungry mice. They're eating exactly the same amount. And yet these guys are getting fat. These guys stay lean. There's a lot more interesting things. This is a really cool study where they then have the mice live together. And it turns out the mice, you know, they eat each other's poop. And if you culture that, you have these guys live together, these guys don't get fat. They will pick up the lean microbiome. And you can see that. And they don't get fat. But that's if you're feeding them this low-fat, high-fiber mouse diet. You feed them McDonald's, they stay fat. Not just enough. So all this hope, oh, we'll get a good microbiome, and then we can eat anything we want. Not so fast.
Do they run around less? Does it cause them to take the lead?
So there is something of a hypothesis about how it works, and it's based on signaling. It's based on molecules that the bacteria are making that are sensed by host regulatory systems that then regulate the liver function. So it's like, so it's a little tricky, right? Because it's not that it's sort of an overall flux of nutrients. In fact, it seems like these guys, the bacteria here, are probably enabling more calories, freeing up more calories in the guts for the host. It's not based on they're pre-digesting something for us. It's really a signaling system, which means, of course, that, oh my gosh, all these molecules that the bacteria are using to communicate with themselves, they're impacting host signaling systems, which are impacting our metabolism. So it's going to be, there's a lot that we have to do to figure this out. But it also means that it's something that could be very impactful. And, you know, you could imagine drugs and therapies and so on based on a better understanding of this.
How strong is the effect? I mean, is it as extreme as here, or is it real?
Oh yeah, it's pretty big. It's large. They're like, you know, factors of two in size. Yeah, they're fat mice. Yeah.
So you're saying the major impact is from the signaling molecules produced by the bacteria themselves, or the toxic byproducts, the metabolites from the cellular processes? So if you could,
yeah,
instead of zinc, it might produce more byproducts, or is it right, saying that's a natural effect?
I don't recall. I think in this case that it was probably some byproducts of bacterial metabolism that were having a particular effect, that if they process this long chain carbohydrates in a certain way, that was then affecting a host signaling system. But again, you better not believe me. There's the paper. Okay, so this was by way of motivation, right? That the microbiome is everywhere. and it can actually have an effect on us. So, all right, so what do you, how do we know that? I mean, and what do people do? Well, you might have thought, well, the easiest thing would be just, well, we'll take my ground, we'll grow up in a lab, we'll do molecular biology, we'll understand everything. But that doesn't work very well because, you know, something like 99% of the bacteria that are living in any place on your body don't actually grow under what would normally be good conditions for something like E. coli in the lab. And so there are other solutions of learning what it takes to grow these, and there's some progress on that. But the alternative route is to say, don't bother growing them. All we want is to extract their DNA. You could also extract their RNA, but this is basically about DNA. And we'll do sequencing, and we'll figure out who's there. And this was sort of originally promulgated by these guys, but it's become much easier as we get, you know, fast, cheap sequencing to do this in a way that gives you really good coverage. And so the idea is, well, you know, you have, of course, the whole chromosome there, and in fact, you can do something called shotgun metagenomics, where you just sequence everything. You just, you know, you use, you know, random primers, and you just collect lots and lots of reads, and then you try to figure out where they map to and so on. And I think that's going to be hugely important. But in the meantime, kind of the workhorse here is to look at a particular gene, the 16S gene, which is very well conserved. Every bacterium has it, and it has regions that are very well conserved, but also regions that are variable. And so let's go over there. So the good thing is you have these conserved regions, so you can make primers here that will basically amplify for all the bacteria, but there's variable regions here which will be different for every strain. And therefore, you've got like a barcode, and you can say, okay, who was there and who was not. And this is just a blow-up of this 16S epigenomal RNA. It's pretty big. You could imagine looking at different regions. There are a few standard choices for where to look at based on their size and the degree of variation, the degree of conservation. So that's what's done. So let me go back, though, for a moment and say, all right, you know, let's say you were going to motivate to do this, to extract it. What might you hope to learn? What are the questions? And so the questions that are motivating the field, one comes down to this issue of diversity, because it turns out that everywhere you look, there is diversity. And I think Daniel Fisher talked about this when he was here a couple weeks ago, you know, trying to understand that. And the answer, I think, from Daniel is that we don't really understand it. Do you think that's fair, Andrew? You were here, that there's some thoughts on this, but why, you know, you don't find one or a small number of bacteria that are just, you know, taking over a niche, or maybe because we don't understand whether there is 1,000 species because there's 1,000 really different niches on your skin right there, maybe, or is this some dynamical effect, that this is somehow the way the system self-organizes, we don't know. So what is the origin, maintenance, and significance of this diversity? And one of the things you see is that there are lots and lots of bacteria that are there in relatively low counts, but they're there kind of reproducibly. And so are they just transients? They just happen to have landed there? Or are they occupying very small niches? We really just don't know. There are many factors that are presumably playing a role in this, certainly the environment, the nutrients, temperature, pH, and so on. But then there's sort of the self-created environment that these bacteria are interacting with each other. They're quorum sensing. They're interfering with each other. They're processing each other's waste products. One bacteria adheres to a surface, and the other bacteria adheres to that bacteria. So they're affecting each other. Now, the ones that are in the host are clearly affected by host immune system. Right? We have various things in our body. If your immune system stops working, boy, those bacteria start, you know, taking over in a big way. And so we're clearly sculpting the bacterial community with our immune system. And of course, there's also a huge role for chance, what you happen to be exposed to. And so the other question then is, all right, that's, you know, in this mouse model, which is sort of a little bit extreme, it's clear that this has a big impact. But is this something that's, you know, a large part of, you know, obesity epidemic? That how much of that has to do with changes in the human microbiome as we live in a more sanitized environment? There are certainly people who believe that this is progressive effect of passing on from mother to child, a more and more restricted microbiome is having a long-term impact on our species. So we don't know, but there are lots of interesting questions. So, so let me just say then a little bit more about sort of what 16S metagenomics is all about, and we'll end on time. So here's the usual 16S workflow. You get a sample from somewhere. We're going to look at a particular data set that comes from the human tongue. You extract DNA. You don't have to grind up the whole tongue. You can just take a little swab there, and there's going to be a lot of bacteria. So usually you do some PCR to amplify the DNA that you've got, and then you're going to sequence that with, you know, Illumina or 454 or whatever sequencing platform you've got, and you will process these reads and analyze them, and maybe you'll get some set of reads mapped in some way. So, well, how do you visualize this? You actually have strings of A's, T's, and G's. What is usually done? And so I will tell you what's usually done, and then back up a little bit and see if this is absolutely necessary. So what you get from the sample, you get these reads. You know, there'll be maybe 200 nucleotides long. There may be errors in them from PCR or from base calling. So you get these raw reads. And what is generally done is to cluster them immediately. These are called operational taxonomic units. There's not meaning. It's not like this is species or something like that. It's an operational taxonomic unit. So you do typically something like this, where you say, oh, everybody who's within 97% similarity of each other, we'll just put them together. And of course, that would make sense if there were tons of errors here. You might as well cluster because, you know, you're trying to resolve within something that's error prone is probably useless. But it turns out that sequencing has gotten better year by year. And so while this may have made perfect sense originally, the error rate has gone down to the point where it's probably not necessary to do that. And that's something that has been our particular angle on this, is to say, can we look inside the OTUs and figure out which one of these actually are real, that come from some bug that lives on your tongue, as opposed to which ones are just PCR errors on top of something that was real. All right, so we should have used this slide. Why did we use these operational taxonomic units? Well, it's to reduce noise. But there was a motivation, which was the idea that if your 16S sequence wasn't noisy, but you had two of them that were real, but they were very, very similar, these are, you know, two strains of E. coli that are pretty close. Why should I care that they're two? I'll just call them E. coli, and I'll be done. And so, but that's something of a hypothesis, right? I mean, how do you know that because their sequences are similar, that these strains are so similar? It's not guaranteed. What it's used for then is to say, well, once I've got this OTU, typically this will have some centroid sequence, and I can go map it to some database and say, oh, this is bacteroides, right? Or something very closely related. So I can say, okay, in your gut, you've got this, 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 and this genus at these levels. Or even if I don't know what the mapping is, or if I do, I can start looking at co-occurrence patterns. I can say, well, I do or don't see these guys going together, and so on. So I can, with these OTUs, I can start to organize the data. And that's certainly what's usually done. But the drawbacks are that maybe you didn't need it, maybe the noise isn't that great, that they're ill-defined. I mean, nobody really told you that this group is somehow a coherent set of strains that are all doing the same thing. And even more, it's ill-defined. Like, how you get an OTU depends on the order in which you find these sequences. So you're not even guaranteed that you'd get the same OTUs. So do we need OTUs? I wouldn't ask if I wasn't going to answer that. No, we don't need OTUs. So just to quickly say, the basic idea is that we looked at this particular data set from Rob Knight's group at Colorado, who's been a big-time sequencer. They had done a study that was super nice in the sense that they got some volunteers who were willing to have various parts of their body sample, including their tongue, sampled every day for more than a year. So we have this long time series, which is hugely helpful. Because if you just have one sample, there's things that vary, and you can say, well, this just happened that day. Who knows? Maybe it would never happen again. But if for a whole year, you start to believe it. And so the idea here is to look at, say, take the most abundant sequence overall for the year from someone's tongue, and then look at all of its neighbors in, you know, in one nucleotide substitution space. And so you'll see that over the length of the read here, so it's this long read, you'll get certain types of substitution appearing more commonly than others, but very consistently. So what you can realize is that, oh, for whatever I'm doing with PCR base calling, there's a certain probability of making an A to G error, wherever it comes from. Which means that, and I can show you that that's consistent, that these different substitution rates are very consistent, not just over this one sequence, but looking at all the top sequences. This kind of error, or whatever it is very common. This one, not so much. This one, very rare. But more important than the range of these is that they're very consistent. So it's just like there's an error rate. So I can now look and say, here's a sequence that's very abundant. Maybe this one is a real sequence that's very abundant. I can predict for you how many neighbors I should just get of each type just by this expected error rate. And therefore, if I see that like this one is, you know, 10 times more than I expected, and I see that on multiple days, because it could happen once some weird thing happened in the PCR, if I see it in multiple days, that's actually a real sequence in the sense that there's another bug in there that actually contains that sequence, and that's why I'm getting those reads. Yeah.
How confident are you about the abundance? Because there's a PCR amplification part that you're using the barcode presumably somehow.
Sure. So the abundance, no, I think that's a very good point, that the absolute abundance of these things has a multiplicative error that could be factors of 2, 3, sometimes even more. So if you're going to say, oh, this, I really care that this is the most abundant guy and this is the second most abundant, don't count on it. And that, on the other hand, we're doing time series. So we're mostly interested in the temporal variation. And we're interested in things that are consistently there at relatively high level. So we're not going to worry about a sort of a systematic bias in the overall abundance of a particular read type. You'll see what we're going to do in a second. I think you'll see. So how that works then is that you can take, for example, this most abundant sequence and figure out which of its neighbors are there due to noise, and which of its neighbors are actually really there just at lower abundance, or, you know, lower sort of effective abundance. And here, for example, is the abundance of the top 10 neighbors of sequence 1 for every day here. And what you can see is that these three guys are not only real in the sense that there's way more of them than you would have predicted from the error model, but they have different temporal dynamics. This guy is there at high levels and dies out. This one's pretty uniform. This one's fluctuating around. So our first case that, oh, things that are very similar in sequence are probably doing the same thing, not necessarily, right? Like this is clearly, you know, dynamically a very different strain than the most abundant one. And so, So looking inside these OTUs can reveal, diversity, at least in terms of the dynamics, which presumably is reflecting the different biology of these strains. And just to set the scale, we typically find, even with very, very conservative cutoffs, that there are order 20 or more real sequences inside of each OTU. There you go. So let me take the next 3 minutes, and I think I can get through everything, just give you a sort of rogue's gallery of what happens. Note that our one nucleotide difference is 99.2, so these would definitely be within an OTU. You would have said these are the same species, but They could be doing very different things. So these guys are close. This bar means they're close in sequence, but they're definitely different bacteria. On the other hand, I can have cases that actually are inside the same bacteria that are very close. So here, the reason that they actually line up is I've multiplied one by a constant. So there's some overall difference, which may be PCR bias or it might be real, but they're doing exactly the same thing. In fact, they're really doing exactly the same thing. These are just counting errors. So these are just paralogs of 16S that live inside the same bud. They differ by one nucleotide, no big surprise. But here is a little bit more of a surprise. These guys are exactly the same, just as correlated, but these guys are only 81% similar, right? So this is, if you looked at those in the sample, you would say those are very, very distantly related bacteria. But in fact, there must have been some horizontal gene transfer because these guys are inside the same bud.
But here you're just showing us the temporal data. Is your error model somehow informing these?
The error model has simply gone to picking like the top 200 and saying these are all real. Okay. So when these are worth looking at and paying attention to their dynamic. And in some sense, it's a check. Like if the errors were like crazy, you wouldn't get this perfect, you know, two sequences lying right on top of each other. So you can say, okay, you know, what is the correlation? There is some correlation between how close you are in sequence and how similar you are dynamically, but it's not great. You can't say that, okay, as soon as I'm, you know, one nucleotide apart, I am identical dynamically. You get lots of possibilities. This I don't think I want to go into. This was just saying that the way you can tell if things are inside the same bug is they're inside the same bug, the only errors are counting errors. So those will be different every day. And so there'll be no persistence of difference between the strands. It'll be day by day. And that's how we can identify paralogs. That's not paralogs. So one other thing that comes out of this is you look at a few examples. You could have worried that I'm sampling the tongue, I eat something in the morning, I brush my teeth or something. Maybe this community turns over very quickly. What do we actually see? We tend to see things correlated over a few days. So that's good. So we can see that sampling every day was not so bad. But in fact, there are some very slow dynamics. So there is this strain that, you know, starts out high and it's one nucleotide from this, and over like 60 days, it slowly dies out of the population. Here's another one that over 30 days slowly comes up. So that there are, you know, there's real sort of coherence and time. Coherence in time of these populations there and slow dynamics. And I think I'm gonna end there. I'm happy to chat with people offline about metagenomics, and I will just then conclude that microbiomes are ubiquitous and that bacteria are living in communities, that metagenomics is looking directly at these bacteria by sequencing is going to be a rich source of data, both for 16S and the shotgun metagenomics, where you just sequence everything. Our modest contribution at this stage is to show that you can, by combining some cluster-free approach with time series or multiple sample case, you can maybe get some information that was not available otherwise. And in the case of this tongue microbiome data, we're learning that there are lots of real sequences in these OTUs. We can tell the difference between paralogs and dynamically similar strains, and we can start to see slow dynamics. But the main message is that there are lots of big questions still to address. So, thank you.
You had two that were 81% identical and presumably are either attached to each other very, very directly or
right.
In the same cell. Have you followed anything like that up with fish or anything like that to actually show this?
That would be, so we've done only theory. But it's an interesting question. My guess would be the natural explanation is they're paralogs, that they're in the same. But it's true. You could imagine that these guys are, you know, they're, you know, pair bonding for life or something like that. That would be interesting. But yeah, you could then go into this and imagine taking this and do fish, which is another fluorescence in situ hybridization. Is something else you can do without culturing. You can in principle go in and look at probes and see where you find them. Yeah.
It doesn't see major perturbation, say somebody had a wound in the mouse or something.
Ha. Huh.
Immune activation in the mouse or something.
Yeah. I don't know. We don't have that kind of data for this.
I certainly bite my tongue every once in a while.
Yeah. I mean, people have, of course, done studies where for the gut microbiome, you take an antibiotic therapy and you can see that there are large changes, certainly. But, and then there's, I think the answer is that you do go, you know, you go back, there's some things that are persistent about your flora, some other things that seem to be not. It's totally Wild West right now, I have to say, particularly dealing with people. Because with people, right, they're eating all sorts of different things and predictably biting their tongues. Yes?
I have to throw one question.
Sure, you may.
Wouldn't a great control have been reverse transcription and to look at active replication just to validate these declines in specific populations over time?
Yeah, I think that one of the directions this field is going is to combine, for example, 16S or shotgun with transcriptomics and metabolomics. So for example, in that work that I showed you from Jeff Gordon, there was a raft of different data types that they brought to bear, and they definitely learned more. You understand, this was not even a collaboration between us and Rob Knight. This was a published data set that we then, you know, got access to, downloaded. Yes?
So the study was about two people, right? So how close, because they were co-inhabited.
Well, funny you should ask. So subject one and subject two are male and female. And if you look at the fraction of common sequences, there's a lot of common sequences. Something like 70% of the ones in each are shared.
So these are the reads which are not human reads, or these are the human contamination?
These are not human. We do not have 16S genes. So these are all bacterial. But it turns out, so the point of this slide was, okay, since you're sitting here, and we've got this slide up, the point was, I've got 20 different species within an OTU, but I'm only looking at 120 nucleotides. That might represent itself, even an exact match, might represent a whole bunch of subpopulations. So maybe it's meaningless. Maybe, you know, even exact identity is only telling me about, you know, lots and lots of different strains that are all doing different things. So how do we make the case that the exact match is actually informative about the biology? And the idea was to take advantage of the fact that they have these shared strains in his mouth and her mouth. And the idea was, all right, let's look at some pair here in his mouth. First off, I should say, if you look at this strain in him and the same sequence in her, they are not doing the same thing in time. They're up and down, she drinks coffee, whatever. They're not like tracking each other perfectly. They're not sharing strains at that frequency. But you could say, well, look, here are two sequences that exist in him that also exist in her. If these guys are strongly correlated dynamically in him, does that predict that they would be strongly correlated dynamically in her? If this really represented 20 different stuff, and this was 20 different stuff, and they just happened to be dynamically correlated by chance, you wouldn't expect those to be dynamically correlated. But if this really represents basically one subpopulation that's doing something, and this subpopulation is doing something similar, you might expect they have the same biology, and therefore these two would have the same biology in her mouth, and they do. So you get a very strong correlation of Pearson correlations. And if you make even one nucleotide difference, you lose most of that. So there's a real difference on this, like exact match means something. As soon as you get one away, you're starting to see very different strains. And that's not surprising. The mutation rate is sufficiently low that you're like one nucleotide, you know, fixing in this region of 16S is like 7 billion generations or something. So even as they've gotten apart by one nucleotide, the rest of the genomes have probably diverged a lot and they're starting to do different things in your mouth. I think better.
Thank you very much.